Continuous improvement comes in lots of different flavors and styles. I'm Bella Engelbach, and I'm inviting you to journey with me to the edges of lean. Episode 120, Communication is a Lean Process with Jeff Weinstein. How much time are you spending every day on communication? How effective and efficient is your communication? We live in a swirl of communication. Email, instant messages, text messages, and social media posts, and sometimes we even talk to each other. Jeff Weinstein says communication is a real edges of lean frontier, one of the places where we can all leverage lean thinking to reduce waste and improve our lives. He joined me at the edges of lean to discuss lean communication. And by the way, he has gifts for you that you can download at jeffweinstein.com/gifts. Jeff Weinstein, welcome to the edges of lean.
Thank you, Bella. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's really nice to have you here. And I was so excited when I started to see your profile and you introduced yourself to me because you said that you talk about lean communication. And that is just fascinating to me as a lean practitioner. I have no idea really what you mean by that. So I'm hoping that you'll be able to explain that to me and to my audience. But can you get started by telling us about Jeff? What have you been doing and how did your career move into what you're doing today?
Yeah, wow. It feels like it's been a long road for me. And, you know, it actually goes back all the way to when I was 10 years old. And it was the first time we were called on to give a speech. And I think you probably remember that moment too. It's one of those things that's really memorable to a lot of people because it's a scary event, right? To stand up in front of people. So I remember it clearly because it went horribly for me. I got up and I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a good message. I didn't have a script. I just wasn't ready at all. And I completely blew it. And so I look back on that event and I almost can't believe that I'm a professional communicator now because it started so badly for me. And you know, that stayed with me for a long time, that fear. And, you know, there's been a lot of studies done on this over the years on how many different fears govern your life. And there's a lot of talk about how speaking in public is one of the greatest fears, greater than death, greater than being bitten by a snake is this fear of speaking in public. And so that was me. You know, I carried that with me for so long until I was probably 18 when my sister got married and she asked me to give a speech at her wedding. And that was the first time I actually held a microphone in my hand and I realized, oh, this can actually be fun communicating, you know? And then when I went to university, I decided I was going to run for student council. And I had to, of course, give a speech during the campaign period. And I realized at that point, not only did I not have to be afraid of it, and not only could it be fun, but there's also some power associated with speaking in public because you have a platform, you have a podium, and people just pay attention to you. And so I started to develop this kind of liking for speaking in public and communicating. So I can trace it back to those types of events from my youth and childhood. And I don't know, is that something that you can recall, Bella, you know, in your early days?
Well, I can tell you that I remember very clearly the very first time I gave a talk at work, which was probably I was in my mid-20s. So I don't really remember the occasions at school, but I remember giving a talk at work, spending a lot of time preparing it. It was a scientific talk because I was working in a scientific company. And I remember afterwards that it felt the whole time as if my heart was beating 150 miles an hour. And I had absolutely no idea how long I had been talking for. I completely lost track of time. And afterwards, people told me that I had done a good job, but I almost had amnesia about it because the experience was so terrifying and a little bit awe-inspiring. But what I was wondering, Jeff, was when you were learning this about communication and about moving from being in a place of fear to being in the place of enjoying it and understanding the power of it. What were you studying? What was your area of study in university?
So I did a Bachelor of Commerce and I focused on the hospitality industry.
Oh, interesting.
So managing hotels and restaurants, because that had been my job as a youth. I mainly worked in restaurants and hotels, with the exception of the summer before I went to university when I worked in a factory, which is also part of the story. But that was kind of where I was heading, was the hospitality industry. I didn't end up staying there for long. After I graduated, I worked maybe 5 years as a manager in the hospitality industry. And then I decided that I was going to pursue my minor, which was in finance, and I went and worked for a big bank. And I had, all the lights in my eyes. I was going to make a bazillion dollars in the finance world. And I was working in this division of a bank, the early days of discount brokerage, online brokerage. And I ended up getting out of the finance field pretty quickly, and I took a job as a communications manager in the head office. And that was really where I kind of discovered, oh, I really like this. This is a lot of fun for me. Taking a message, no matter what it is, and conveying it to people to produce change, to produce a reaction, to produce excitement and energy. I realized, wow, this is actually a lot of fun. And so I did that for about 10 years. I ran a couple of different communication teams and training groups, and really kind of solidified my path for life at that stage after a few job changes and way far away from hospitality.
Wow. I love to hear these stories of people whose career moves in different directions. It sounds as if you particularly followed the thing that was exciting you and giving you that sense that you could really make a difference. So when you started working in communication, what did that mean? Was that written communication? Was it writing speeches for people? What did it all involve?
Yeah, in the early days, I was working in what they call the mid office of a bank, right? So you've got the front office people who deal with the customers and sales and the marketing and all that. You've got the back office that does all the nitty-gritty work on the accounts and all of that stuff that has to happen. And then in the middle is this what they call the mid office, which bridges the gap between the front and the back of the house. And we realized very quickly that there were a few areas that my job entailed. Communication was one of them, but that wasn't the primary thing right away. It was a whole bunch of other operational stuff. And we realized between the two of us, me and my boss, that the communication was the single biggest area of brokenness that really kind of touched everything that happened. Right? It touched the front of the house, the back of the house, all the processes that had to happen. Everything hinged on good communication, and it just wasn't happening. The letters to the customers were absolutely atrocious. They were the old school, thinking and almost threatening tones that you might hear from a bank. Not so much these days, but back in that time, we didn't have as much of a refined approach to customer service. And so there was brokenness there. There was brokenness between the teams. There were delays happening all the time because of miscommunication. So we decided then to focus on cleaning up the communication. And much of that was the written word. So it was letters and a lot of letters going out to like a million customers, right? We're getting these letters. And so we decided this is where we're going to focus. So I was kind of an accidental communicator in a way, because we didn't set out to name me the manager of communications, but that's what he did. A few months later, he changed my title to manager of communications.
When you
And
were
that's how it.
sending a letter to a customer, Jeff, were you expecting something to happen? I mean, I'm sure there were all kinds of letters, but what was there an action or reaction that you were expecting, and how often was that really happening?
Yeah, the banks, they send letters for all sorts of reasons, right? And one of the ones that we looked after was anything regulatory in nature would go from, our back office. So the regulator would enact a change, then that would come to our team in-house, the regulatory team. Then they've got all these subject matter experts, but they don't know how to communicate it, right? They just know here's how it works. And then the idea is that the mid-office group, that was my team, then we would take that kind of subject matter expertise and turn it into a letter. And then it would go out to a million people. And the idea is that then these people would understand that there's a regulatory change. Here's how it affects you and your holdings with us, and understand this is why we're doing it and what you need to know. So it was kind of informative in that kind of a case. Other times it was a credit letter where somebody's offside on their account and they need to be notified that they need to bring their account back onside. So there are all sorts of different reasons that we would go out. Actually, you just reminded me, I'll never forget. I had this one experience with my boss, and we were kind of learning the ropes together about how to communicate these complicated issues. And I wrote a draft of a letter, and I guess it wasn't very good, you know, because he took it and sat down with me and he started going through it line by line. And it took us about an hour and a half to get through this letter. It was one of the most painful and humbling experiences of my life because he hated it. And he didn't hate it just because it was badly written. He hated it because he didn't get it.
So
And
you had written the letter. You had written the letter. It was perfectly clear to you.
yes,
Oh, you thought it was
exactly.
clear to you. Are you
You got it exactly. I thought this was a pretty good explanation of this regulatory change, but he didn't think so. And he didn't come out and insult me. He didn't say he hated it. But because he stopped so often to ask for clarification, I thought to myself, obviously, I didn't do a good job capturing the essence of this idea because he doesn't get it. And I swore to myself, I said, I am never going to sit through another meeting like this with my boss. I'm going to figure out how do I clear this up before it gets in front of him. And that was a really pivotal moment in my understanding of what communication was all about. It's about getting that message across as clearly and accurately as possible, but in a way that the person on the other side reads it and understands it immediately. So that kind of became my mission, right? Was just to create communications that did that, so that people weren't confused, they weren't stumbling, they weren't asking for cleanup on it because I had done the job the first time. That was really the impetus for me to start looking in the direction of lean communication. That was kind of the root of it all was that event, that 1 hour and a half.
All right, so let me ask the question. When you say lean communication, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, so I guess tying it to that story, it's about stripping out all of the stumbling blocks that prevent a person from getting the message that you put in front of them. And now in lean terminology, we call that waste, right? And in
Right,
a manufacturing process, we look at all the different sources of waste, and there are lots of them. With communication, similarly, there are lots of sources of waste that prevent a person from visualizing what it is you're trying to say, understanding it, and then doing whatever it is you're asking them to do. So it's being able to communicate that message quickly and concisely for a person.
And that's assuming all kinds of things, right? That the person is able to read the language that you are writing in or that you're speaking in. I think there's a lot of assumption or assumption that we have going into communication about the people who are going to be receiving our communications. So what percentage of communication out there in the world today would you say is wasted, is waste?
Oh, percentage. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, it de depends on so many things. Some organizations I come to and their communications are already quite lean. That's not really my target client because they already get it and they've put those practices into effect. And typically they've got a leader who believes in that and has insisted on it in their organization. The organizations that I go to, as soon as I see an example of a communication that's not lean, like you're asking me about, I know pretty much a majority of their communications will not be lean because they don't have the right mindset of lean thinking built into their communication processes. So in those cases, yeah, it's a majority of their messages are waste.
That's so interesting to me because, as As people go into organizations, as leaders in organizations want to do a transformation, want to transform their organization to a lean thinking organization. We talk a lot about change management. We talk about communicating the change, but I don't know that we ever really get down to the nitty gritty of what does that really mean to be communicating as a lean communicator? What are the kinds of things that we should be changing about how we think about communication in order to do that better.
So think about it as a lean process like any other. And so if you think about the value stream that you map out, you start from the beginning and you go to the end. Okay. And so at the beginning of that value stream is the creation of the message. So that's one stage of your process. The next stage then is transmitting or sending your message, depending on whatever channel you've chosen to send it. Then it arrives on the other side, and the person then takes over the process at that stage and they read it. They open it and they read it, hopefully, right? And if they understand it, then they'll take the action. So kind of like a four-step process. You create the message, you send the message, they receive it and read it is the third step. And then the fourth step is they take the action. So the value tied up in communication is the action or the result that you're trying to get out of the person receiving your message. And so the thinking that needs to go along with that is at each stage of the process, what do I need to do to make my message as lean as possible so that we can get to the action as quickly as we can? Because in the workplace, we don't send a message just for fun. We send messages because we're trying to accomplish something. And so the value is tied up in doing what I ask you to do, because once you do that, then there's a shared win of some sort. And so that's the thinking that I challenge people to get into is think of it as a process. Think of yourself as the value stream manager. And in each stage of that process, strip out the wasteful stuff so that you get that person to the desired action as quickly as you possibly can, so that you don't waste time overwriting your message or over preparing your speech, whatever the case may be, right? And you're creating it in a way that it speaks the language. You mentioned that a few minutes ago, the jargon that we have as subject matter experts, right? We got to make sure that the language matches. We got to make sure that it kind of looks good and sounds clear, and there's a good message, and all of those things that go into a good crisp communication, realizing that you're in charge of that to make sure that the downstream stages work smoothly and efficiently. And a lot of it comes down to the upfront. And then the thinking that goes into the upfront then is, well, what does that experience look like on the other side? When somebody opens it, are they going to be resistant to my message? Do they have barriers up? Are they busy? Are they distracted? Do they know my topic or not? Like all those things, thinking about the audience, you've got to build that into the front end of the process so that the back end works well. So there's lots of thinking that goes into it.
And doesn't it obviously it has to work two ways, because in our lean organizations, we want the people who are doing the work to be able to communicate to the people who are setting the strategy. So we want that back and forth to happen. So does it also then include coaching people on the front lines to communicate back effectively?
Yeah, if that's where the brokenness is, absolutely. Yeah. One of the groups that I worked with, it was a manufacturing organization, and I was working with their team of lean apprentices, and that was actually where I learned, I kind of cut my teeth on lean in that customer. And they said, we've got these lean apprentices who are experts at this part of the process, and they now need to find lean projects and introduce them and sell them to the frontline workers. So that communication that you're talking about, yeah, absolutely. You have to train people on how to then communicate it to the front lines and get the feedback from the other people so that you can implement your lean program. And so we did it through presentation skills. They would be delivering a presentation on their lean project from where it began, where they identified the waste they were going to strip out, and how, and what they needed people to do differently. And so there was a whole change management process built into that as well. And yeah, communication at every stage of that program was critical. And so we had to coach and train these apprentices to do that effectively. But understanding that it's not linear. Communication is not just you fire a gun. That's the old way, right? You fire a gun with a really strong bullet, and it kind of goes into the person, and the impact makes them listen. And we know it doesn't work that way because there's
Right,
always a loop. There's feedback, and so being being connected to the way people are responding to your message and receiving it is part of the story too.
when you start to work in an organization, what are some of the wastes that you see that are very typical?
Yeah, I can pretty much spot it right away. So in the written word, it usually shows up in email first. Email is normally these days, that's kind of the number one place leaders are asking me to come in and help because they say, we got an email problem. We need help with this, and so it shows up in, here's a very simple one. So when you send a message to somebody, you think to yourself, well, who else needs this message? And you start building a list of CCs. Well, I'm going to send it to this person and that person because they're really closely connected to this project. But I'm going to send it to this person, that person, and that person too, because they may, need it. They may need to know. I'm not sure if they do, but they might need to. Well, what you've done now is you've added three people to your list, and you've put in front of them an email, a distraction that probably isn't overly relevant to them right now. And you've asked them to stop doing something else so that they can focus on your message. And you've completely interrupted their day. And now you add that up over the course of the day. How many CCs does the average person get? Lots. And how many of those, when you ask them, how many of those CCs are relevant to you? Well, a lot of the times the answer is not very relevant. And so that's a really good example of waste that I see all the time is just not thinking about how, we're doing that. And
Well,
people
and
just have never been.
it's not just the CCs, right? It's the people who hit reply all
Oh my goodness,
and what that
there's another
does.
good, yeah, there's another great example. You keep reminding me of all these things that I see. So I was working one day, I was doing a workshop in person at one of my clients, and they had about 12,000 people in this division that I was working with. It was an IT group. And as we were sitting there, somebody said, Jeff, there's a great example happening right now. And so a message had come out from the leader of this group. And they were trying to let everybody know that there was a change happening, but they didn't mask the recipient list. So all 12,000 people were on this original notification, and it had been cascaded to everybody. And then somebody hit reply all. 12,000 people got this reply all. And then a whole bunch of other people started chiming in with their opinions. And then some people started coming back with, well, take me off this list. Stop replying all. It got ridiculous. And within about an hour, there were 200 reply alls to the original reply all. And everybody was going crazy. They crashed their email server because there were so many messages flying around on this one. So that's just another example, just not really thinking about how you're going about doing it and what's the impact on the person on the other side. So that's just one area, Bella, that I see. I don't know, I could go on for a little while. I've got
Right,
lots of other areas there, right?
I guess the thing is about email is that we kind of feel like email is free, right? That it's quick and it's easy to send someone an email and to copy some other people on it, and I make the assumption, other people make the assumption, well, if this lands in somebody's box, they know about it. And I love what you're pointing out. You're actually stealing time from people when you're putting it in their box, because they may be opening it, looking at it, thinking about it. And if it's not too pertinent to them, you are actually taking time from them. But the other thing is, on the background, and your story of them crashing their email server is a really good example of this. It actually costs, money to run email service, right? Email is not free. It takes up data space. It's using up bandwidth. And I may not feel it, you may not feel it, but somebody somewhere is paying for it. It takes energy. We're burning coal or whatever, so that we can send each other emails that we don't really need. I think there's a lot of waste behind that that is invisible to us.
I blame America Online. It goes, well, it goes back to 1993. I'll never forget the first time email became widely available was when AOL launched their platform on the world, which included email. And all of a sudden, everybody's sending all these messages, and that's exactly what they said. This is free. I don't have to write a letter. I don't have to put an envelope and address it and put a stamp on it and then send it, this old snail mail that we so-called now, right? And AOL brought it out, and it's not really their fault, but they didn't introduce a best practices manual. They didn't say, here are some things to watch out for, because it was so new. Nobody knew what to expect. Nobody predicted what was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, people just are given this tool to do what they want with. And it became a free for all. And really, it's been a free for all ever since. It's 30 years later, and we still haven't solved the problem of email. It's all those habits that we embedded in the early days, and nobody really tackled it in a meaningful way. And organizations just kind of ignored it and let it happen. And that's where we are now, right? And there's a lot of stress with email these days. I have clients who say, we're so busy with email that I have to come in early and stay late just to deal with the messages that have come in over the course of the day, because I'm in back-to-back-to-back meetings all day long. There's another thing we could talk about. But then, I'm coming in on weekends. I go away on vacation. I'm so stressed out about what's happening that I check in once or twice a day just to keep up with my email. And there's a lot of stress going on with email. So it's really become quite a beast.
And so then it does make me wonder how many of those messages are really important.
And therein lies the question and the idea of lean thinking. Back to that again, it was such a great question. What thinking? The thinking is, when I send this message, who really needs it? Because if you don't need it, it's waste. If you don't need it, it's negative value, because you're taking me away from something where I was producing value. And yeah, so.
And then, but then we have a sort of a fear of missing out, right? So, and I mean that in a business sense, not in a, oh, they went to a party and I didn't get to go to the party kind of thing. But something is happening organizationally and I didn't get a communication about it, and it actually does impact my work. So I'd like to go back to when you were talking about that first step in the process of composing the message. Deciding what the message is, does that include also deciding who the message is for? How does that work?
Yeah, it has to be part of the initial thought process, because you can't craft a message if you don't know who it's for. If you don't have a very specific audience in mind, your message is not going to resonate with anybody. So that's number one, is deciding who is this to, and what's the message I need them to hear, and what action do I need them to take? And then you build your message. We usually do it backwards. We start thinking, well, I'm a subject matter expert on this and I need to communicate this. So I'll sit down and write the message, and then I'll fill in all the names of people who now need to get that message. When in fact, it's an inefficient way of creating the message. Because if you just thought about, well, I'm going to send this message to Bella, what does she need? Well, she needs this, this, and this. Okay, great. I'm going to write it quickly, efficiently, and tell you what I need. And then I'm going to send it to you and you alone. So that you can get the value out of it as quickly as possible. And I get to bother putting other people on the table, because it's not relevant.
But it does also then beg the question of being, I'm fascinated by this. So I'm a subject matter expert. I have a piece of information that you all need to know. It's about, it sounds like having a very clear idea about who is this piece of information really of value to, right? If we're looking at a value stream, who is it really of value to? Because if you're just throwing out all these valuable things and the people are really not interested in them, you're wasting your own time and their time. But if we do it the other way, and I think this is the temptation, Jeff, I'm sure you hear this from your client. Okay, so I have a group of, let's say, 15 people, and I need to communicate a message as a leader, perhaps, to those 15 people, right? And so I send it to those 15 people. I've already sort of, I have to dilute the message a little bit because exactly what one person needs to hear and another person needs to hear may not be exactly the same, right? But I also don't feel like I have time to write 15 separate messages. So how do you manage that? What's it, how do you pare it down to what is the one thing that the 50 people need?
Yeah, so there's a way to write an opening paragraph. I call it the power paragraph. And the power paragraph is basically your meta narrative that applies to everybody. And it provides a statement of context. It's three sentences, very simple. Three sentences. There's a context statement, a problem statement, and a solution statement. So that's the meta narrative, okay? Once you've done that, you can actually stop, assuming that people don't need any more detail. But if you need to add a bit of detail, then you go below that paragraph and you say, okay, here's how it works. And here's what I need each one of you to do. So, Bella, I need you to do this. And Steve, I need you to do that. And Vivek, I need you to do this. And so on. You can then call out the individual actions for people. And you bold their name so that they can see which piece applies to them, but you don't make them read everybody's. You just help them see their own. Because as soon as I see Jeff, Geoff, as soon as I see that on the page, I'm like, oh,
Oh, it's Jeff. It's me. It's me.
that's for me. And I'm going to go read
Yeah.
that piece, right? And so that's how you can kind of do it. You can give a piece for everybody and then specific actions for everybody else. And if there's, nothing for five people, you don't put them on the list.
Right. Yeah.
And then as well, when you're sending it, make sure that anybody who's got an action is in the to line, and everybody else, if you want to copy them for that FOMO factor, then you put them as CCs with the expectation that they may or may not read it. And if they don't, that's fine, right?
It's okay to not read something you CC'd on if the person has composed the email appropriately.
Yeah, in fact, I rarely use CC because I've heard so many people say to me, Jeff, I don't even look at my CCs. I send them into another folder. This is how I manage my day. I'll divert all the CCs into a folder that I'll get to maybe one day. But I might not ever get to it because I'm pretty busy with the twos. And so I've heard so many people say that that's the way they manage their inbox that I don't even bother CCing people anymore. I just send messages to the person I need to take action. And that's as far as I go. And that's lean thinking as well, right? Is who needs this message, and who do I need engaged in this? And that's where I focus all my attention. This FOMO doesn't matter to me too much. If there's a person that I think may need to see it, rather than CCing them, I will send a second message and forward the original to them and say, just so you know, I sent this message to a group of people. And you may be interested because it affects your area in this way. I'm going to leave it with you to decide.
I love that you're saying, here's why I think you might be interested. I think it makes a really big difference because that now you're not just saying, well, here's something that randomly you may or may not be interested in or need to know about, but I actually know enough about what you do, or I care enough about what you do to send you something that might be of value to you. Of course, and you can always decide if it is or is not. Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the top five pet peeves that I hear people talk about is when you send me, you forward me a message and you say, see below. Because I have no idea what the context is or what you want me to look at below, but now you want me to go and read the entire string of emails and then
No.
magically pull out the value? How does
Right.
that work?
And in Gmail, if you're using Gmail, they're all threaded and then some of them are folded up and you have to unfold them and say,
Oh.
what the heck is going on here? Yeah.
So
Yeah.
again, what you've done is you've devalued that person's time by creating extra work for them that again may or may not be relevant to them. And they don't know. They just have to make a guess. And again, I'm always thinking, how do I get them to the action as quickly as possible? And so I'm kind of self-interested in making it easy for them because I want what I want. Right,
right.
I want them to do something. So how do I remove all those distractions and barriers and get people as quickly as possible down to business? So it's kind of it's audience focused, but it's also self-centered in a way,
To
right? To be honest.
get done what you want to get done. So,
Yeah.
Jeff, how long should an email be?
One line is usually not enough.
Mm.
And it depends on the complexity of what you're sending. But like I described before, that power paragraph is often enough to get the conversation started. So those three sentences, it's a perfect formula for an email for me, because I read it, I understand where did it start, what's the problem we're trying to solve, and what's the solution that you're proposing. And if it's simple enough, you can confine it to three sentences. And I advise my clients to do that as often as they possibly can to keep it lean. And it's a little tricky at first to learn how to do that because you gotta, as a subject matter expert, right? You gotta remove all the stuff that you know that you want to talk about that matters to you, but it doesn't matter to the other person. So you gotta get disciplined to remove all that stuff. So three sentences often is enough.
Can you give us an example?
An example.
Yeah.
Yeah, give me an industry. Give me a scenario.
Okay, so you have a team of people and they have a guest coming in next week who's going to give a talk on a new program they have to institute.
Okay. And what's the hypothetical program that you have in mind? Do you have any ideas?
It's a software to keep unwanted email out of their inbox.
Okay, great. So the context would be a statement of that in one sentence summarizes the story that we find ourselves in. So, good morning, everybody. As you all know, email consumes way too much of our time. And I know a lot of you are stressed. Trying to keep up and trying to get everything done, period. That's a long sentence, but you get the
Yeah.
idea. And I'm pleased to let you know that we have an expert coming in to talk about this topic and to introduce a new program that we're going to be running to reduce the burden of email on each and every one of you. And I ask you to be there Friday morning at 9 a.m. And come ready to talk about your email stressors. Something to that effect. Now that's a really long version of it. I
Yeah.
obviously I would be it would be shorter. I'm trying to be a little dramatic in my delivery of it, but that's kind of the idea, right? Is that context statement that frames it for everybody nicely, the problem statement which gives it urgency that makes it relevant, and that creates a desire in the audience to attend because you've hit on a pain. You kind of like poke the bear. Right? Poke, poke, and you're hitting something that they care about. And then you're providing a solution or relief from that problem that's all framed right here. So that's the way that I would put it together. That's an example.
And I like something else that you did. I don't know if that's something that you always recommend, but there was a real tone of empathy in there as well. It was as you were stating the problem, you were stating it in a way that acknowledged their feelings. So it was about bringing, it was about bringing emotion into it, not
Yeah.
just pure business.
And it's great that you caught that because that is a pillar of being lean. It's a shortcut. If you can put it in terms that it's relevant for your audience, they're going to listen. If you make it all about you and your expertise and what you know and what you're trying to communicate, all the details and facts and knowledge, for whatever reason, you might have good intentions, but you get stuck in your own head and your own content. If you can turn that around and say, what does Bella need? And that's what I'm going to give her. I'm going to put it in terms that she's going to look at it and say, I want that. I need that. If you can do that, then you're going to be a lean communicator simply because you're jumping the queue over everybody else who's just talking about themselves all day long. You make it about me, then I'm going to pay attention as long as it's about me.
Which means that as a lean leader, you need to be or already be doing those things that lean leaders need to be doing, such as listening to people, spending time at the Gemba, really getting to know what's happening in the organization. So you can provide that type of insight, which you can't do if you're doing it from a, the head office 15 or 50 or
Yeah.
500 miles away. You have to be there somehow.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was working with a finance team, and they decided that they were going to put out a new process for expense reimbursement. Here's a simple one, right? You want to get your money back? Here's the form. Use it and use it this way. Here's all the details. And they put this massive paragraph, I think it was about this big, of process on how to use this form and how to fill it out. And they talked all about the form. Use the form, use the form. Here's how to use it. Here's how to submit it. And I looked at it and I said, oh my goodness, this is just a user manual that you've turned into an email. So I said, hold on a second. Why do we need to have this template put out there for people? And they said, well, everybody's complaining because they're not getting their reimbursements quickly enough, but they're not filling out the form properly. So we got to re-educate them, obviously, on how to use the form. No, no, you don't tell somebody that they need re-education on how to use a form and expect that you're going to get change. It doesn't work that way. You give people, the desire to change by giving them something, some hope. So we changed it around completely. And the context statement was, many of you have been letting us know that you're concerned with how long it takes us to reimburse your expenses. I'm pleased to tell you that we've streamlined our process so that you can get your reimbursements much more quickly. And if you fill out the template following the guide below, you should see everything within 2 weeks of submission. So every sentence there was about the reader. It was nothing to do with, we want you to follow this process or use our form because this is the way it needs to be or the policy or whatever. Forget all that stuff. Nobody cares about that. All they want is their money back. And so make it about that. That's lean thinking. Because you're stripping out the waste that you're imposing on your communication and focusing instead on what the audience needs and the value they need to get out of it.
What the customer really needs. I hope somebody also took a look at that form and figured out why it was so hard to fill out and made some fixes to the form as well. That would
They
have been,
did. They
they
streamlined
did good.
everything. Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Brian, what are the kind of work that you're doing now? Is it all? I mean, it sounds like it's you've done a lot around email, but what other kind of communication work are you helping people with?
Yeah, so it takes a few different forms. One of them is one-on-one coaching, typically with a VP level and business owner level. So one-on-one coaching on their own personal communication skills, whether it's the written word or the spoken word or some combination of the two. So that's one form that it takes. And I literally sit there and we work on messages they've prepared and delivered, and we figure out where's the waste. Why are people not catching your vision? Why are they not doing what you're asking them to do? And so on. So there's one-on-one coaching on that. I also work with small teams, and so that means anywhere from 6 to 20. And it's a team typically of subject matter experts, really smart people who are struggling to communicate. And so we'll figure out what's the area that you need to really focus on. Is it your proposals? Is it your reports? Is it your customer letters? Is it just email overload? And then we'll work through that problem in a methodical way. Typically, I have a 30-day program that I work with teams where we do a virtual, then they do some online stuff. So that's another form that it takes. I call that the lean email program. And then the third
That's
one is
cool.
more of a, yeah, that's pretty cool. And then the third area that I've been doing a lot of work recently is face-to-face with presentation skills. That's become a really popular one. It kind of comes and goes, but these days it seems, I think with AI, we're seeing a shift in if we're taking away mundane tasks from people. On the flip side of that, we're asking people to step up and be a little bit more, what's the right word? A little more influential in the way that they pitch their ideas. And people, for some reason, I think COVID has something to do with it. People are really gun shy to get up and talk and communicate. and go to face-to-face meetings now. I think they've been so safe behind their computers that they've forgotten about the face-to-face experience. And so I've been doing a lot of work in that area in the last 6, 12 months.
Yeah, I imagine it's there's people who have been, not had the opportunity to even do it for the past few years, But, I mean, we're seeing conferences start to come back and face-to-face meetings start to come back, but I can imagine that there are many people who really haven't even had the chance to do that kind of face-to-face communication or making pitches or doing conference presentations.
Yeah,
So it
it's true. And again, when you have subject matter experts who are you're asking them to make those pitches and presentations, and they've always only ever been a subject matter expert. They've never been a pitcher for the ideas. They know, what their system or process will do, but they don't know how to sell it. And they have no idea how to do that. And so you're almost asking for them to develop a whole new set of skills. But when they get up, their natural instinct is not lean at all. Their natural instinct, again, is to get up and do what I was talking about with email, where I dump all my knowledge into the presentation, and then I leave it up to the audience to pull the value out of it. No, that doesn't work. You can't rely on your audience to derive the value. You need to put the value right in front of them, and you need to teach people how to do that, because it's not natural for those subject matter experts to do that without coaching.
Wow. So lots of work to do, lots of ways to improve communication. And Jeff, I apologize. I feel like I called you Brian a few minutes ago. I have no idea why I did that, but you're
No
definitely
worries.
Jeff.
No worries
So,
at all.
all right. So I'll say your name again. Jeff Weinstein, can you tell us how people can find you?
Yeah, so they can find me on LinkedIn. So my name is Jeff with a G. So Geoff, and then Weinstein, it's like Einstein with a W on the front. And it's jeffweinstein.com is my website. They could also find me by typing lean-email.com if they want a shorter version. Lean-email.com
That's
will
so cool. I
shortcut
love it.
over to my site. So that's a couple ways they can find me.
Thank you. And let me ask you, what is your one piece of advice for a young person starting out?
Oh, you know what? I was just the other day coaching a young fella at one of my clients. He was 22 years old, and he's an intern, but he's an intern with a lot of value to this group. And so they said, "We're going to do one-on-one coaching with Jeff. We're going to sponsor this for you." And just a wonderful young man, so friendly, so likable, but has never learned how to be an influential or lean communicator. So I said, "Listen, if there's one thing you can take out of this, it's this: is look at communication as your greatest asset, because a majority of people out there have no idea how to communicate their value. And so be clear and be concise and be influential in the way that you communicate with people. And you're an intern now, but you're going to be in a position later. If you can do this, if you can focus on communication as your greatest weapon, you're going to be your greatest tool. You're going to be far ahead of everybody else coming out of your program and starting in the workforce." So that was the advice I gave him just the other day. So I guess I would leave that advice for everybody as well.
That's
It's honestly people who have been in business for decades and decades and never learned some of the things that we've talked about today.
I think that's really excellent advice, and anything that anyone can do to improve the quality of communication and the impact of communication is going to make a real difference, because there's just, as you said, so much waste going on,
Yeah.
and it's
And
taking our time and our energy.
it's the thread that holds everything together. Everything that you do every day, it's a universal tool that we all use. And so let's make it work, right?
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jeff Weinstein. Thanks for traveling with me to the edges of lean, and keep on communicating in a lean way.
My pleasure. Bella, thank you so much for having me.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Jeff Weinstein for being my guest at the edges of lean. What did you learn from this conversation? What ideas did it spark? We would love to hear from you. You can find Jeff at jeffweinstein.com/gifts, where you can get a free copy of his book, Buried Alive. He's also on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn or at leanforhumans.com or comment wherever you watch or listen. And check out all my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com, where you will find lots of great new content every week. The Ages of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelberg with support from Podcast Inc. This is a Lean for Humans production.